Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that refuses to be restrained by the walls of history. We've ranged from ancient Rome to modern Washington, from Pompeii to Troy. And today we have one foot on the Great Wall of China and another on the US-Mexico border, because our subject today is walls and borders. Why do we seek to separate? Do walls work? Are they ever a good thing? Dominic Sandbrook is with me, and I want to start with a wonderful, simple question we received on Twitter from the excellently named Tom. Tom asks, what makes a good wall? Dominic, what do you think?
Golly, what makes a good wall? Well, I suppose it depends if you're keeping people out or keeping people in. So the emblematic wall that you and I grew up with is the Berlin Wall, right? That's the wall that we would have thought of for most of our lives when people mention
walls. I'd have thought of Hadrian's Wall.
But, would you?
Yeah.
A man living in the past, yeah.
I was much more interested in Hadrian's Wall than the Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall, of course, should probably be known as the Anti-Fascist Protection Rampart, which I think is a great name for a wall. I mean, I think a wall needs a good name, and the Berlin Wall had a great name. And it worked. That's the one thing people forget. I mean, the Berlin Wall was a monstrosity, but it actually did work in its purpose.
Because it was set up to stop people from East Berlin fleeing into the Western sectors.
Right. So about 3 million people had fled from East Germany to West Germany between, say, 1945 and 1961, when the Berlin Wall went up. And after 1961, I think that total fell to about 5,000. About 100 people were shot. So the Berlin Wall, you know, hideous as it was very effective, actually.
But presumably also dependent on the existence of the Iron Curtain, so the frontier running right the way across Europe, dividing the Warsaw Pact from the NATO powers. Because if you don't have an Iron Curtain joining up to the Berlin Wall, you could just go round the corner of the Berlin Wall, couldn't you? And that's always a problem with walls, is that,
well, I mean,
they come to an end point and then you can just go round the side.
Yes, I suppose so. You're right that there was the Iron Curtain as well. So that, I guess, that's going to be a theme of this episode, isn't it? That walls and borders are often the same thing. Not always the same thing, though. So Donald Trump's wall is not actually really a wall. Most of it is a fence. And there was already, a fence along the US-Mexican border.
So what's his status now?
He's going to, as we speak, he's going to visit it. He's going to pay a sort of farewell. They've built a tiny bit of it, I think, and he's going to go and say how beautiful it is. This is his great, great kind of legacy. But it's not a wall, obviously. I mean, it was a ludicrous proposition that it was going to be a wall. It's a fence, and there were fences on the US border anyway. But the thing with walls and fences is even the Berlin Wall, some people can get over or under them. That's the nature of borders. People cross them. Unless you're talking about North Korea, in which case you don't cross that one. I mean, you get shot.
Yes, I mean, that is the kind of, essentially the iron rule that you can always break through a wall. But, and judging it by that standard, what would you say has been the most effective wall?
Most effective barrier in history.
And the only reason I'm asking you that, of course, is because I've got an excellent answer.
Okay.
So it will make me look good. Why do you think? Okay, I would say the Theodosian walls.
Do you know, I've got the Theodosian walls written down in front of me.
Of course you have.
I don't think they're effective, but they're very...
They were very effective. They're built in the 5th century and they hold out till 1204. I reckon that's a pretty phenomenal record.
That said, if there's one city in the world that's famous for being sacked twice, it's the city behind the Theodosian walls.
I know, but the poor Byzantines are surrounded by voracious enemies. And basically, this is the great legacy that the Roman Empire at its it's still a great power, leaves the Byzantines is this incredible fortification system that obviously the people of 9th or 12th century Byzantium couldn't possibly have afforded. But they have this incredible defensive system of walls that you can still go and see. I mean, if, you know, to walk around the walls of Constantinople is still one of the great things that you can do. So yeah, that would be my nomination. But if you've got a better one, I'm
happy. It's a good choice. So yeah, you mentioned Hadrian's Wall earlier on, and we might as well get into Hadrian's Wall because I know you're itching to talk about it. And Hadrian's Wall is, I was there 2 years ago, and I sort of went in that sort of cynical state of mind where you're expecting to be a little bit disappointed because I went as a child and hadn't been for, 40 years or something, and was expecting, to be underwhelmed. And it is an amazing thing, isn't it, Hadrian's Wall?
Well, it depends which bit of it you're looking at. And I say this with some feeling because I've actually walked it three times. So I walked it when I was about 17. I walked it just after I got married. I persuaded my beloved to walk with me, and that almost ended our marriage because we got lost. We got very badly lost.
How can you get lost at Hadrian's Wall?
Because it was before they'd set up a national path. So I misread a map, and anyway, fortunately, we're still together, but it was quite close. And then about 7 years ago, I made the whole family do it, and the children were quite young, and I assured them it was going to be exciting. And of course, we set off from Wall's End, and it just bucketed down with rain.
You could never possibly have anticipated that, could you?
No, and I've got some very happy holiday snaps with the children sobbing in the kind of outskirts of Newcastle as the grey rain slices down, asking me why we couldn't have gone somewhere warmer. But I agree, Hadrian's Wall is fantastic. And I suppose, I think for me, it's the archetype of the wall. I always think of, and I think it's fascinating because we don't entirely know why it was built. So the only detail we have from classical sources is written about 250 years after the life of Hadrian, and it says the wall was built to separate the Romans from the barbarians, which is very kind of ambiguous. So is it built as an expression of strength? So saying, we control you. Perhaps they whitewashed it to make it stand out. Perhaps it was kind of equivalent. People had to present their passports to get through. It's about making a massive statement of Roman power. Or is it built as an expression of weakness, in which case it's about keeping the barbarians at bay? And there's a kind of ambivalence there in the way that the walls are built. That's true of the fortifications in China or wherever. Yeah. I suppose even America. Do you feel strong when you built it, or are you projecting weakness?
But that's the ambiguity, isn't it? So that's the story of the Great Wall of China, that you have to be a very rich and sophisticated society to build it, but you don't build it unless you're worried about steppe nomads, raiding you and sort of pillaging all your towns and stuff. And presumably that's the case with Hadrian's Wall, right? That it's both, isn't it? That you have to be the Romans to build it, but equally, if you were so powerful, you'd have conquered what is now Scotland.
Yeah. We see, and what's interesting about the Great Wall of China is that the idea that it's great is basically a Western one.
Right, interesting.
I mean, you'll know this because it's Nixon.
It's Nixon. I was thinking about Nixon on the Great Wall.
Because Nixon goes,
he says famously, "This is a great wall,"
and it's a great wall for a great people, or something.
Yeah, that's his famous soundbite.
There's a brilliant book. I don't know if you, by Julia Lovell on the Great Wall.
Yeah,
and apparently got that phrase got rewritten by Chinese propaganda as he was meant to have said, "It's a great wall for great people
that come
from a great past, and only a great people that built it again have a great future." And sort of endless greats kind of multiply. But I mean, the Great Wall of China, we think of it, it's basically a kind of showpiece.
But that's because it's been renovated, hasn't it?
So the bit that you go and see is actually just a very small bit. But I mean, ultimately, there was no one Great Wall of China that has lasted for thousands and thousands of years. And it seems to have kind of begun almost as a kind of gulag, as a kind of, the first emperor sending people off to work themselves to death in the the remotest corners of China. So that, again, is another kind of dimension of wall building, is that it's an expression of autocracy, it's an expression of power. And those who do it are, you know, it's built with their bones. Their bones are kind of ground up to become part of the mortar.
Isn't that sort of true of all grand projets, you know,
I think it is.
In history, isn't it? The pyramids and, you know, the people. It's that sort of slightly tedious thing when you, when you're a child and you have a, you know, your parents have a friend who's a bit left wing, like me, and says, who built the pyramids? And you say, oh, Ramesses or whoever it might be. And he says, no, it was built by thousands of slaves and don't you forget it. I mean, that's a kind of standard
thing. There wasn't slaves, was it? It was kind of Keynesianism. It was giving everything something to do. During the fallow period.
So let's talk a bit about not just walls, but borders. Do you have a favourite border? Yeah. Oh, come on, what is it?
A favourite border? I think the sea that encloses Great Britain.
Oh, good choice, good choice. But you see, we're unusual.
Because natural borders. You see, natural borders, that's...
But most borders aren't natural. That's what's so interesting. So there's a fantastic map online that you can... There's a website you can go to, and there's a map, and it tells you the dates of every major... Well, not every major, every modern nation-state border. And by far, the sort of plurality are 20th century. And actually, when you go back, there are very few that are... older than about 1300 or 1400. So I think one of the oldest is Spain and Portugal, which is 1297. Spain and France is very old, but most of the others are pretty new.
Well, Scotland and England. I mean, kind of 11th century.
And that, but that's sort of shifted a bit, hasn't it? That's always been a little bit fluid, Scottish-English.
Well, it's kind of interesting. Hadrian's Wall stands in for the border between Scotland and England, where it's further south. And so there is this kind of idea that England is a natural inheritor of the Roman province of Britannia, and Scotland is a natural inheritor of the barbarian lands north of Hadrian's Wall. But that's not true at all. I mean, it's a kind of coincidence that the border tended to lie where it is.
Yeah, interesting. What about the border between Wales and England? So that's kind of seen as the same as Offa's Dyke, isn't it? People use Offa's Dyke as a kind of... I don't know anything about Offa. Does anybody? King of Mercia?
Well, I think with Offa's Dyke, again, you get this kind of... the same ambivalence that you have with Hadrian's Wall. Is it a statement of royal power? I mean, it is a statement of royal power, because for an Anglo-Saxon king to have the manpower to construct this enormous earthen dyke, I mean, that's pretty impressive by the standards of the time. But at the same time, it's kind of an admission of defeat that you can't bring the Welsh to heel, and you've got to build this to stop them from raiding. So again, it's this same kind of uncertainty that you get with, I suppose, with, you know, it's in a way that's there with the Berlin Wall, isn't it? It's there with North Korea. Is it strength or is it weakness?
Yeah, if you're so great, you don't need a great wall.
Right. But also, of course, walls stand in for, you know, just be mentioning this, walls stand in for natural borders. So for Rome, you've got the Rhine, you've got the Danube.
Yeah.
So they, to a degree, provide natural frontiers. And I suppose the desert as well. I mean, the Roman Empire reaches its limit of natural expansion, because southwards there's only the Sahara, eastwards there's only barbarians.
Well, and then eastwards... You could go east into sort of Mesopotamia, couldn't you? I mean, the Romans don't have
you
to
could.
Stop.
Yeah.
And did that, was that border kind of fix the Roman-Persian border? I mean, it presumably was a little bit. That must have been very fluid.
Yes, it is. Because in particularly late antiquity, there is no natural feature there. So you essentially have to construct massive frontier posts. And the story of the relationship between the Romans and the Persians in late antiquity is a constant process of scrapping over key nodes of defence, which constitute the border. But I suppose what you have in modern history that you don't have in earlier periods is the sense of a solid, definite border. I mean, I think even Hadrian's Wall is It's not a line drawn in the sand, because Roman power would be expected to project northwards. You know, troops would be expected to control the frontier zone northwards and also southwards as well. And the history of Roman defences is that, to begin with, you have the idea that Roman power is limitless, that empire is without borders. This is the divine dispensation. Then you get the sense that you're going to kind of slightly build defences along the line of the Rhine and the Danube or whatever. Then you have defence in depth, and then you just give up because the whole thing gets swept away. So there are many different ways to have borders. And I suppose moving into the medieval period and early modern period, I mean, borders are constant. Say Poland. I mean, talk me through the borders of Poland. But I can't even begin to wrap my head around that.
No, I mean, Poland is the famous one, isn't it? Because even in the 20th century, it changed multiple times. And, you know, what is Poland now? What we all accept to be Poland would not have been accepted to be Poland in 1935 or 1900 when Poland didn't even exist on the map. So those things are interesting. I mean, people often say that the borders are a product of the Treaty of Westphalia. So that's 1648, the treaty that ends the 30 Years' War. And people see that, some people see that as the moment that sort of enshrines the nation state. But if you go back even further, so if you go back to when Spain and Portugal were carving up the New World, I mean, they had to get a deal brokered by the Pope, the Treaty of Tordesillas and then the Treaty of Zaragoza, which basically said, you can have this bit, we'll have this bit. There's such and such a parallel as the dividing line. So there was a sort of, I think once you've got maps, you've got borders. You know, once you can write it down and draw it, then you've got a sense that this bit is ours. It is inalienably part of our realm and that bit is yours. But what I don't have any sense of, and I've never really seen anybody explain it, is what happened if you decided to get on your horse and to ride across, you know, Central Europe or whatever. Do you just keep going and nothing changes? Are they posts, gates? Are you conscious of the language changing and all this sort of stuff?
I mean, in the context of the broadest context of Eurasia, that is the huge issue, isn't it? That you've got horse riding nomads, and then you've got everybody else. Or in the context of the Middle East, you've got people on camels. Because actually, the very oldest wall, I think it's excavated by French archaeologists, and they just call it the Très Long Mur. So the TLM.
God, they couldn't think of a better title than the Very Long Mur.
It's brilliant. It's about, I think, about 170 miles long. It's in the desert of Syria. It's a kind of art. And it's clearly there to keep the Bedouin, keep the nomads out. And it's the kind of precursor of all those other walls, of which the defensive frontiers along the Rhine and the Danube, the Sasanian empires, the Persians, they have one from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea, China, of course, that there is this constant anxiety that if you build a great, stable civilization and there are people out there on horses who can come in and grab it, you've got a problem. The issue is there even with cities, isn't it? That the first cities, in a sense, walls have to be there because otherwise people will just come and grab your stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that's... Well, a wall is an intrinsic part of a city, isn't it? And a border is part of... I mean, this is, I think, one reason why people get so hot under the collar about... I mean, it's not obviously the only reason, but it's one reason why people get very hot under the collar about migration, about kind of migration stories in the newspapers, is that a border is intrinsic to a nation state. It's a sort of nation state sense of its own inviolability, that you have a sort of well-regulated border and that people can't sort of swan in and out. And that clearly is a motive for a lot of people. I mean, that's why Trump got that success with the wall. And it's also, I suppose, I mean, if you're thinking about emotive walls and borders, think about Ireland or Northern Ireland specifically. So there you've got two different, you've got the Irish, Northern Irish border, but you've also got the so-called peace walls in Belfast, which are walls to keep people apart, Catholics and Protestants. Have you done that tour in Belfast of all the sort of...
I haven't.
I mean, it's extraordinary, you know, because, you know, in lots of ways, Belfast looks like a, you know, you could be in a city in, people will probably be horrified by me saying this, but you could be in a city in Scotland or Northern England or something, and you're driving along, and then there's this massive wall, this massive barrier that's keeping, say, the Shankill Road and the Falls Road apart. And they would have gates, well, they still have gates, which are sometimes locked at night so that people can't get in and out.
Right. Well, that's, I think, a somber note on which to end the first half. We'll be back in the second half with some of your questions on walls and borders.
Hi. I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. A reminder that we've cranked up production while Britain remains in lockdown, two podcasts a week till February. So please do get in touch. We'll always announce the subject of our next pod on Twitter. And we really do appreciate all your questions. Talking of which, we'll be coming to questions in a minute. But before we do, Dominic, you had a particular theme that you wanted to bring up.
Well, I thought of something that when we're talking about walls and borders, which is something we haven't addressed, which is enclaves. And they are so interesting. So one of the most famous ones is the city of Kaliningrad, which is a Russian enclave surrounded by basically what's now Poland, but what was East Prussia. And that's the city that was better known for most of history as Königsberg, city of Immanuel Kant. The Soviet Union took it at the end of the Second World War. They didn't give it back. They never will give it back. The population is now Russian. And there's this sort of outpost of Russianness now in what used to be a Prussian city in the middle of the European Union. An extraordinary thing. And of course, there are lots of enclaves all over the world. We just don't really know much about them.
Well, I suppose West Berlin was an enclave, wasn't it?
West Berlin was an enclave, exactly. So, I mean, how strange that was. West Berlin surrounded by a very hardcore, you know, communist East Germany for decades, you know, and I was apparently fixed.
Yeah, I was tipped off about the peculiarities of the original border between India and what ended up as Bangladesh, which, of course, right. was drawn by Sir Cyril Radcliffe originally, who also did the border between what becomes India and Pakistan. And it turns out there were loads of enclaves there that I think only got sorted out between Bangladesh and India kind of like 20, 30 years ago.
But this actually goes to the point that we were talking about earlier about borders, that most borders are quite recent because they've been constructed in the wake of the disintegration of empires. So when people were drawing borders, even in Western Europe, so Austria's borders, for example, they had to have plebiscites at the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to decide would Carinthia be Austrian or would it be Yugoslav. So there's always this sort of arbitrariness, and you have to have enclaves if you're not going to force people to live in, as it were, the wrong country. And I don't know which is, I mean, probably enclaves are better, but you've just had a war in Armenia and Azerbaijan about the enclaves, about Nagorno-Karabakh and all that.
I mean, one of the issues, I suppose, particularly in areas of the world that haven't had the inheritance of the Treaty of Westphalia to, you know, haven't grown accustomed to it, is that actually empires are far more kind of
representative of how power has been organized. And one of the advantages, I suppose, of empires is that you can have enclaves because you're all part of the same imperial structure. And essentially, in the Middle East, that's empires have been the natural way of things, going right the way back to the time of Sargon of Akkad.
Or the Balkans. I mean, the Balkans were Roman, they were Byzantine, they were Ottoman, or Austro-Hungarian. Then that all fell apart. And then, people just started fighting about where they start and end.
But it's also, isn't it, it's to do with the rise of technology as well, and mapping, as you mentioned before, and essentially the ability to have accurate maps, to draw lines on them, and then to ensure that those lines are upheld. So moving on to the question seamlessly, we have one from Paradoximoron. That's an excellent name.
That's a great name.
And he remembers, during my master's, I had to write an essay on the hardening of the world's borders. It turns out that most of the world's borders have become more heavily guarded since the end of the Cold War. What do you think explains this? Well, this is a question for you, Dominic, but one thing that just hovers on my mind. Have you been watching The Serpent?
No, the Jenna Coleman serial killing thing.
Yes, so Charles Sobhraj, who was a serial killer of backpackers in the 70s. And the absolute tension about that revolves around the fact that there's no internet, there are no mobile phones, that he can take backpackers' passports and then they've got no way of getting out. And you can kind of, you can take photographs out of passport and put another photo in and just use it as your own. And you realize how, in 40 years, how 50 years, how radically technology has hardened the ability of states to monitor who comes in and out of their countries.
I've got a terrifying passport border story for you, Tom. I once got an overnight train from Estonia to Russia. And as we were pulling into St. Petersburg, I realised that my passport had disappeared and I couldn't find it anywhere. That's not a good point to find.
It's terrible.
You're an undocumented alien entering Vladimir Putin's
Russia.
What
year was this?
It was about 2002, 2003, but they were in the middle of a huge panic because a lot of bombs were going off in Russia. They're in the second Chechen War, as I remember.
And so, Dominic, be honest, you look like a Chechen terrorist.
Exactly. And you know where it was? So basically, the woman who took care of our sleeper carriage had come in and done all the laundry. She was desperate to get all this sort of laundry, get all the bed sheets off and everything. And she'd whipped up my passport, and it was at the bottom of this massive laundry bag.
So you managed to find it?
I did. I made a huge scene, and it was that classic thing. It was that English thing of, I thought, is it worse to make a scene and embarrass myself in front of all the other passengers? Or should I just take the 10 years in the Russian prison?
I can see that's a difficult one to weigh
up. Which I can console myself that at least I showed a stiff upper lip.
I hope you took the 10 years in prison.
No, I didn't. Well, I didn't, clearly. As I wouldn't
you cry. Yeah. Fall on your knees and sob.
Anyway, we actually haven't answered Paradoximoron's question at all. So my answer to his question is as simple as migration. Migration has hugely increased, and borders controls have increased with them. With migrant flows, don't you think?
Yeah, but don't you think that the borders have hardened because people can harden them?
Yes, I suppose so. So now you have to give a fingerprint when you go into the United States or whatever, and they take endless photos of you and all that sort of carry on, which I guess they didn't before. You just had a sort of piece of paper and a man glaring at you across the desk.
Yeah. You can't go anywhere without the right papers now, whereas...
No. That's because we're so sensitive about migration, though, isn't it? That wasn't the case in 1992 or something when, the phrase asylum seekers was barely used in the news and immigration into most European countries was pretty low. Don't you think it's a product of the anxiety about that?
Yeah, I suppose so. But I think it's also about, if the technology's there to... enable you to do stuff, then you do it. Which brings us very neatly on to another question from Amy Matravadi, who asked perhaps a discussion of the Great Firewall of China.
So well, this is the future walls, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
So this is the...
That's a good question.
So now the issue is not you're keeping people out or in, because that's keeping people out of China is not really something that I imagine the Chinese are terribly worried about. It's more about keeping... ideas out. So am I not right in thinking that there's some issue with Winnie the Pooh in China? Are you aware of this?
That's right. Yes, yes. Xi Jinping looking like Winnie the Pooh in the Disney film.
And so Winnie the Pooh has been suppressed in some way. I mean, this is clearly going to
get a non-bear.
He's a non-bear. This is going to get us our podcast suppressed in China. Oh, my God. But, yeah, how effective is this? I don't know. Does it? I mean, only time will tell how well this works. I think clearly it doesn't work with Lutheran ideas in the 16th century. It doesn't work with Enlightenment ideas or communism. You can't keep ideas out, I don't think.
The phrase the Great Firewall of China is kind of interesting because, you know, we're saying how the idea of the Great Wall of China is essentially a European invention. Europeans start going there and having, you know, rhapsodizing about this amazing wall. And then the Chinese wake up to the fact that they've got this incredible thing. And you start getting all these stories about how it's the only structure that you can see from the moon, perhaps even from Mars, I think Joseph Needham said. And so the Chinese end up very proud of it, and it becomes an emblem of their ability to protect their civilization from the barbarians that lie out there. Now, whether that was the original purpose of these kind of various fortifications that collectively have come to be called the Great Wall of China, I don't know. But I think that the idea that China is the great center of civilization, it's the Middle Kingdom, and you put a wall around it to keep the barbarians out, that is something that goes with the grain of Chinese national pride as it's evolved over the past century, really. So maybe that's a part of it.
I think it is, and I think actually you're right, and that if you talk to Chinese people about it, they don't say, well, this is a sign of weakness and of our insecurity. They see it as you say, I think they see it as a sign of, this is who we are. We control what comes in and out. It's a sign of our maturity and that we're sensible, that we don't let the internet become this anarchic free for all that you have in the West, that we want to have a sense of regulation. And of course,
they've got a point.
Well, maybe. I mean, who knows? I mean, we're speaking, this is a couple of days after Donald Trump's been kicked off Twitter.
Yes. No one in China is on Twitter, are they? They've kind of banned it. They've got their own.
They have their own parallel things, don't they?
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. They famously, notoriously, they haven't got rid of the president of Iran. So he's still
tweeting. No, who's still on Twitter? Yeah, he's still on Twitter.
He's busy tweeting. Well, here's another modern wall. From, I hope I'm going to pronounce this right, Pepin Luka, the Israeli wall separating the Israelis from the Palestinians. How successful is it?
Thank you for asking me this very uncontentious question. Well, I suppose you can argue it's ultimately successful only up to a point. I don't really know, and I've never been to Israel or indeed Palestine, so I don't really know. I don't have any first-hand experience on which to draw, but the thing with the wall is you can build a wall, but the other people are still there, right? And the issue is still there. It doesn't go away. So, I mean, an Israeli, if you had an Israeli spokesman, they would say, well, it's improved security or whatever. But of course, the point, I suppose, for the Israelis is at what point does that wall become a greater problem because of the international PR damage? You know, at what point does it harm your cause rather than help it? I don't have an answer to that.
I mean, again, as in China, so in the Near East, there's a lot of history there. So one of the towns in Palestinian territories is Jericho, which possibly has some of the most famous wall in the whole of history. And, you know, all over the Near East, you've got these kind of what are called tells, so dust mounds that were once cities, and we've got the very long wall as well out in Syria. So you do, I mean, perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, in that area of the world, walls have an incredibly long history. And I suppose that the Israelis live in the shadow of that kind of incredibly ancient history. Okay, so here's the next one from Ollie O'Brien, and this is something we've already touched on. When did borders become an actual thing? 1648 and the Treaty of Westphalia, or not until faster transport and more people travelling by train? An example being German unification, I suppose. I think we've been kind of hovering around that question, really.
When you have borders,
as we understand them now, definite lines with border posts, satellite absolutely determine where exactly these borders are. When did we start getting the idea that, they are definite lines on a map rather than just kind of vague areas of control, kind of frontier regions?
I don't actually have an answer to that, Tom. I think it's interesting he mentions train, because obviously trains, some people argue trains invented time. So train timetables invent a kind of national uniformity of clocks. So every station has to have the same time and all the rest of it. At what point, I mean, this is the thing that puzzles me, actually, that genuinely puzzles me. At what point are you on your horse and you're in France, then you're in Luxembourg, then you're in, you know, one of the states of what becomes Germany? How conscious are you of it? Is there somebody stopping you? And at what point is there somebody stopping you? My guess is we're talking 19th century. But I don't know. And when people did the Grand Tour, they didn't need to take loads of documents with them, and they didn't have to stop and have their bags searched.
I suppose travel was so expensive that if you were travelling, you were automatically assumed to be a milord, and that meant money.
Maybe,
so everyone would
yeah.
welcome you with open arms. Happy days when British tourists were still welcome on the continent.
Yeah. But one thing, we left with bags of marble.
coming from a very different angle, is that perhaps one of the things that constitutes a border, say in antiquity, is the idea that the land is sacred. So in Athens, in Attica, I mean, Athens is unusual in ancient Greece because it controls such a large quantity of territory. And that territory is seen as being sacred. So the Athenians see themselves as being autochthonous, born from the soil. And you have to be buried in Athenian soil. And unless, if you are born from Athenian soil, then you are Athenian. There's no other way you can become an Athenian. So I suppose, if you have a sense that the earth itself is sacred, I mean, I suppose that's part of Israel as well. The idea of a promised land, a holy land. With the Romans, you have a thing called the pomerium, which is a sacred border that marks the sacral limits of the city. So, if you have a sense that land is sacred, then I suppose inevitably you probably have a sense of borders as well. But I'm not sure about that. Something to.
I mean, the sort of trendy thing to say, right, is that borders are always fluid and they're terribly interesting and they're much more interesting than non-borders and all the rest of it. But borders aren't always that fluid. So I mentioned Spain and Portugal earlier. I mean, that border has remained pretty much where it is for, I think, 800 years. And the people on either side, in all that time, they've had a pretty clear sense of themselves. We're Portuguese, you're Spanish. I mean, there must have been a degree of fluidity.
But they don't think they're Spanish, do they? Because within that border, other borders. So the borders between, what's going to become, Al-Andalus and then Valencia and Castile and, all these.
Yeah, no,
I mean, that's kind of shifting and changing. So perhaps you have,
And the borders in South America, right? The borders in South America follow often the patterns within the Spanish Empire. So the administrative divisions, why is there Argentina and a Chile and a Uruguay and all these places? Often they follow the administrative divisions of the Spanish Empire. And actually, Bolivar, when they, in the great age of sort of independence fighting, he dreamed of a Gran Colombia, this big super state, and it failed. Because the individual elites wanted to cling on to their borders. They wanted their little power bases.
And the British as well. I mean, almost across the globe, wherever there's some particularly
thorny,
terrifying flashpoint, it turns out that a British map maker
has
been there, from Northern Ireland through Israel.
Although, Tom, I always think this is a great cop-out, isn't it, for people generations later to say, it's the fault of those evil mapmakers. And actually, I really need to go and massacre my neighbours, and it's not my fault at all.
Well, I suppose the British and Spanish are coming from a continent in which the idea of borders is taken for granted. and going to parts of the world where they're kind of rather alien ideas. And because Western power was so preponderant over the 20th century, this idea was kind of taken for granted and is implicit in the United Nations and things. But it's actually, it's expressive of an age of Western power that is in retreat now. So I don't know whether the notion of a kind of Westphalian border will fade as well. I don't know.
No, that's a good point. And I guess actually one other point. There is a point. Maybe we British are too cavalier about borders precisely because we don't have one.
Yet. But we may. If the Scottish independence vote goes what I would think be the wrong way, but not necessary.
One for the Scottish.
Okay, here's another question. Again, I hope I pronounce this right. Tim Chiplovsky.
Chiplovsky.
What was the last functioning walled city, and will they ever make a comeback? I don't know that. Do you?
So there are lots of walled cities still, which function, but I mean, people don't besiege them, I suppose. Is that what he's looking for? Because how do you...
Well, maybe a city where the wall is an important part of its functioning. People aren't allowed in or out.
I mean, there are walled cities, aren't there? Best walled city. I'll tell you the
Vatican,
best walled city.
Might be one, I suppose. The Vatican has a wall, doesn't it? So that marks out the limits.
I'll tell you, have you been to Dubrovnik? You must have been to Dubrovnik, Tom. That's a very... I mean, the wall
No, I've never been to Dubrovnik.
Never been.
No.
The wall is a huge element of Dubrovnik's... So Dubrovnik, is King's Landing from Game of Thrones. And the wall is a huge element of Dubrovnik's appeal. And the wall has actually both made and destroyed Dubrovnik in the sense that it's the reason people go. And because people go, it has become a sort of Disneyfied resort with colossal cruise ships, which has leached it of its character. But in terms of walled cities, I mean, that is the best walled city you'll ever go to.
Okay, well, it's absolutely on my list, and you know, dreaming of a time when I can go and see it. But my answer to that last functioning walled city would be the Vatican. So
okay,
but I may have got that wrong because I'm not an expert on walled cities. So if anyone out there has a better suggestion, we'd love to hear from you. Well, I was going to give you another question from AJ Bremner. Is a wall only a successful wall if it's guarded? Good question.
Yes, I suppose it is. Well, if you're not guarding a wall, what's the point of it?
I mean, there's an interesting debate among Hadrian's wallologists about whether there was a walkway on the wall. I mean, you'd assume that there would.
On the wall, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the soldiers can walk up and down the wall.
Yeah.
It's a topic of massive debate. You know, archaeologists fall out about this.
Then there must be thousands of books that are utterly erroneous and redundant in which soldiers are looking out from the wall.
Aren't there? I mean, yes. Yes.
Surely, I mean, I must have read 1,000 articles in which African soldiers are looking out over the wall. And
well,
this is a...
They're in forts. So clearly they are serving a kind of defensive purpose. But the wall is seen as being more of a kind of, you know, customs marker, or said before, expression of power or something.
Yeah,
that it's not a platform for actually defending against barbarians. So
to use your Game of Thrones analogy, it's not wildlings aren't hurling themselves at the wall and being beaten back by. Is there any evidence of that? Did anybody ever attack the wall, Hadrian's Wall?
Yeah, we've got records of people attacking it, going round it, breaking through it. So it must have had some kind of defensive purpose, but the question is whether there were soldiers kind of walking up and down it, which is, I guess, the stereotype of it. That's what you imagine happened, but it's much debated. Well, I think we must draw a line.
Draw a wall
under this.
I've got a wall. I've got a wall for you, Tom. Do you know about the Cottesloe Wall?
No, I don't.
You know about the Cottesloe Walls in Oxford? So Cheryl Hudson tweeted us about this, and it's one of my favourite walls because this is very surprising to a lot of people. So these are two walls, basically, that went up in Oxford in the 1930s to separate the middle class and working class areas. So basically what happened was a developer had the right to build a load of houses, and he put up a spiked wall to deter people from the local council estate from trying to get in. And these walls stayed for about 25 years. And they were incredibly controversial. I mean, sort of,
that's amazing.
People campaigned against them. I mean, they came down in 1959. So in other words, if you'd gone to Oxford in 1958, you'd have found a street where you'd walk along and there'd be a spiked wall in the middle of the street to keep the council tenants out.
And this was legal?
Yeah. Well, there were huge legal battles. It went on and on, and the developers refused to take it down. And the council, you know, they kept finding loopholes so the council couldn't enforce it. And of course, a lot of people were hugely shocked by it. But the local homeowners were all for it. They didn't want the...
And is this only something that happened in Oxford?
Yes, I think so. I mean, maybe listeners will know of other such wars, but I think Oxford...
That confirms my darkest suspicions of Oxford.
Of Oxford. Well, you're a Cambridge man, aren't you? So you would,
yeah, I'm not surprised. Not surprised. Well, let's draw a line under this whole sorry business. Build a wall. End this podcast. Dominic and I are going to go off and do some sentry duty. Thanks very much for listening to us. We'll be back on Thursday.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.